Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. As world leaders are wrapping up efforts to hammer out a climate change agreement in Paris, today we're going to air an interview taped last week with a leading climate scientist, Jeffrey Severinghouse, a scientist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, who was recently appointed to the National Academy of Sciences. If you know any climate change skeptics, listeners, please sit them down to listen to this compelling interview in which Professor Severinghouse explains exactly why there is no doubt that climate change is real and not part of a natural cycle, but rather caused by man's activities pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, which he can prove, as well as what can be done to save our planet. Also today, we'll have a report from Public News Service on the Supreme Court's action on a case involving California's assault weapons ban. Plus, hear about a fire at San Diego State University. Then on Green Scene, we'll have some good news from the Anza Borrego Foundation about acquisition of land that creates a wildlife corridor all the way from the desert to the mountains. Also, learn about efforts to create 3 national monuments in California's desert regions. Then hear about a wild car chase through El Cajon that ended in a crash and an attempted carjacking. Today, we'll also have an interview with Jarrah Al-Obeidi with the Iraqi Center for Dialogue. He'll be telling us about a youth conference focused on challenges and solutions that will be held on December 17th right here in El Cajon. And finally, this holiday season, we'll hear from David Dickens, an East County resident who is a direct descendant of Charles Dickens. He'll be sharing his reflections on the true meaning of A Christmas Carol, his famous ancestor's beloved holiday work. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. In the last week, climate change has been much in the news, with the Global Climate Summit going on in Paris and Climate Change March in San Diego. I've been interviewing prominent politicians, and a couple of them, when I told them about the 97% of the world's climate scientists who now believe that climate change is real and that man is contributing to it, you know, a couple of them said, well, who are these climate scientists? So we thought it would be a good idea to bring one on the show.
Great. I'm a card-carrying climate scientist.
Card-carrying climate scientist. That's
really.
Right. So skeptics, tune in. My very special guest today is Jeff Severinghouse. He is a noted climate scientist and professor of geosciences at Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. He was recently elected to the prestigious National Academy of Sciences, an organization of top scientists founded by Congress way back under President Abraham Lincoln, dedicated to advising the federal government and furthering science for the public good. His research focuses on using gas bubbles trapped in ice cores to track changes in ancient climate change. He's done measurements in Antarctica and Greenland, and his newest research raises the question of whether the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels could also produce a more rapid change in climate than many computer models on global climate have already predicted. He was a Clara C. Patterson Medalist of the Geochemical Society for his breakthrough research in environmental geochemistry, and he's held several fellowships, including a graduate fellowship with the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and with the University of California and the American Geophysical Union. Most recently, NOAA's annual State of the Climate report came out and revealed that 7 climate records were broken in 2014. Jeff Severinghouse, our guest today, has famously observed that if this is the Earth's annual checkup, the doctor is saying you are gravely ill. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Marian. It's good to be here.
Tell us how you first became involved in studying climate change, of all things.
Well, when I was growing up, spent a lot of time outdoors. My dad, you know, took me on long backpacking trips and, you know, just I became a lover of the outdoors, and I knew that my career somehow had to include being outdoors. And so I gravitated towards geology and geochemistry. And I think that's probably how I eventually ended up studying climate.
Very good. You call yourself a paleoclimatologist. Can you tell our listeners what exactly that means?
Yeah, paleoclimatology just means the study of ancient climate change, and it helps us understand how the climate system works so that we can predict better what's going to happen in the future.
Very important. I've got some figures here that over a million years of ice ages and hot spells, the ice cores showed the carbon dioxide levels ranged from just under 200 parts per million to under 300 parts per million. But since the industrial age, about 200 years ago, when all the factories started pumping fossil fuels into the atmosphere, the CO2 levels have risen to 400 parts per million today. So, Jeffrey, there's certainly a lot of skeptics out there who aren't convinced that climate change is real. For those folks, is there any scientific validation behind those who say that today's levels are just part of a natural cycle?
No, definitely not. The CO2 that we measure in the ice cores, you know, showing it variations, as you said, between about 200 and 300 parts per million over the ice age cycles, that CO2 came out of the ocean. It was a natural CO2, and it has a completely different chemistry than the CO2 that's accumulating in the atmosphere right now, which is from fossil fuels. And you can tell the difference between the two types of CO2, actually. They're not the same gas, even. So it's an absolutely no doubt that humans are causing the current increase in CO2, and it's coming from fossil fuels, and it's got all the fingerprints of fossil fuel CO2, not oceanic CO2.
Thank you for educating our listeners on that very important point. Can you summarize some of your most important research findings and what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm mostly trying to understand what causes rapid climate change. Sometimes we call it abrupt climate change, because that is one of the great unknowns going into the future. As humans add gases to the atmosphere that cause warming, it is possible, though we can't say for sure, that some threshold will be crossed and the system will snap into a totally new state, which could be much, much warmer.
How bad could it get?
Well, just to give you an example, we know from looking at the ice cores that about 12,000 years ago, there was a 15 degree Fahrenheit warming in Greenland that was obviously not caused by humans. That was a natural mm-hmm. event. But the whole thing happened in about 10 years. And so It's very, very fast. That's what we call abrupt climate change. And so if humans were to sort of accidentally trigger something like that in the future, then, you know, we'd be looking at much more profound consequences with, you know, 15 degrees Fahrenheit, being a much more severe number than the currently predicted, 5 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit that the computer models are suggesting.
Right. That's where we can get into rising seas and areas of drought where agriculture would not be possible, or maybe areas that wouldn't really sustain human life.
Right.
Let's talk about the recent findings from NOAA, that annual State of the Climate report we just talked about that you said indicates the doctor says you're gravely ill. Here were some of the findings of it: about 7 climate records that were broken last year alone. It was the hottest year on record in many places around the world since record keeping began. That includes Europe, Africa, Asia, Mexico, and parts of South America. Greenhouse gas emissions are also up. Sea surface temperatures were the highest on record, and so were ocean temperatures, since oceans trap those greenhouse gases. The sea levels are also rising, over 2.5 inches since 1993, as the glaciers are melting. And speaking of glaciers, Antarctica's rate of ice melting broke a record last year, too, and Greenland's ice melting rate was also above average. So, Jeffrey, you've done some research involving the oceans and their role in all of this. Can you tell us how important the role of oceans is in climate change?
Yeah, oceans are very important, and the reason is that they soak up an enormous amount of heat. the extra energy that's entering our planet's system right now because of greenhouse gases is an enormous number, and 93% of that energy is actually going into warming up the ocean.
Wow.
It's just because water has a very, very high capacity to hold heat. And so the ocean, in a sense, is our friend. It's actually keeping it from being nearly as warm as it would be. We would have had about double the warming that we've actually had if we didn't have an ocean to soak up all that excess heat.
What are the consequences of ocean warming at such a rapid rate?
Well, the thing that happens when water warms, it expands. So just the warming of the ocean itself causes sea level rise, mm-hmm. in addition to the melting of glaciers. So it's right now it's about half and half. About half of the sea level rise is due to ocean warming.
Yeah. So that can impact everything from the wildlife, fishing and whales and things in the ocean, but also the weather patterns. When we talk about an El Nino, that is fueled by global climate change, ocean warming. A lot of people have a misconception, I think, that climate change only means warming, but it can also mean extreme weather patterns that bring, hurricanes, snow, all these other things. Do you want to comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, the very snowy winters that we've had paradoxically are a consequence of human-caused warming. And the reason is that the atmosphere becomes more wavy as it becomes warmer. And so you get these jet stream waves that sort of bring cold air very far south during some winters, but not others. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be seeing a lot more extreme weather. We're going to be seeing heat waves, real scorchers like the one that killed 70,000 people in Europe in 2003. And then we're going to see, be seeing some very snowy winters where it'll be, in a deep freeze and over the eastern U.S. for a whole month, at a time, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. So people shouldn't be surprised by those
very
cold winters. Yeah.
In the past has included ice ages. Could we have another ice age?
No, absolutely not. Because right now all of the big glaciers in the world are melting like gangbusters. And so they're not, to get an ice age, basically you have to build a huge ice sheet.
Yeah.
And so it's not going to happen.
Tell me a little bit about the core samples that you've actually pulled out and what some of the findings are that your own research has discovered.
Yeah, so my students and I wanted to test this idea that methane would come bubbling out of the ocean and out of the tundra and cause excess warming, additional warming, mm-hmm. in what we call a feedback, where heating causes release of gas, which then causes more heating, which then causes more release of gas.
So a vicious cycle.
Yeah. So we wanted to give that hypothesis, as we say in science, a rigorous test, And so we measured a gas in the bubbles in the ancient ice called carbon-14, which is another one of these rare forms of carbon. And we were able to show that during the last abrupt warming event that happened about 12,000 years ago, these methane sources were not active. And so in a sense, that's good news. I mean, that's one of these threats that we can check off saying, nope, that, we don't have to worry about that one.
So
that's one of the achievements of my group, is to show that the methane problem that has been talked about so much of, Arctic methane coming bubbling out, that's actually not going to happen.
So it's the CO2 and the greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere ourselves that are their concern, not things that have been stored there for a gazillion years.
Yeah, exactly. So the CO2 is really the problem, that it stays in the atmosphere so long. It's roughly speaking about a third of it will be left after 100 years if you put a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So what we're doing is we're effectively setting a time bomb for our great-grandchildren, and it has a 100-year-long fuse.
Wow. Can you please explain your innovative theory of what some writers have called a stripping of clouds that normally cover the ocean, how that's happened in the past and what that could mean for the future?
Yeah, so this comes out of, again, from the ice core research. What we found in the ice cores is that the southern hemisphere, from Antarctica to Southern South America to New Zealand, all these places show a dramatic warming upwards of 12 degrees Fahrenheit in a rather short time, just a few hundred years, at the end of the last ice age. And looks like the whole end of the last ice age was really triggered by this southern hemisphere rapid warming.
What caused that?
And it's not known. So my theory is really an attempt to explain that dramatic warming. And I should emphasize that this theory is not proven yet. It's just a theory. But the idea is that the ocean is very dark in its color. Think of a black parking lot on a hot summer day. And then think of how much cooler that parking lot would be if it were painted white. That's the essence of the idea. It's really very simple. The clouds are white and ocean is dark. So if you take in a part of the earth, which today is almost always covered by clouds.
The ocean.
The eastern, southern hemisphere, Pacific Ocean is where I'm thinking mostly. This area currently reflects a lot of sunlight back to space because it's white. Mm-hmm. If you were to strip off those clouds, you could suddenly have sun shining on dark colored ocean.
So it's going to absorb a lot more heat directly.
Absorbs a lot more heat directly. And so that's my hypothesis.
What makes the clouds be stripped away?
Yeah. And so atmospheric circulation, it turns out, if you move the whole rain belt, the tropical rain belts, into the southern hemisphere because of rapid southern hemisphere warming, you will strip away all those low clouds in the southern hemisphere tropical Pacific.
So the warming that occurs from pumping CO2 into the atmosphere from all these cars and factories and so forth can actually accelerate stripping away the clouds. So you're not only getting more CO2, but you're also allowing more sunlight into the planet. Is that what you're saying?
Almost, but not quite. It's the uneven heating that's the problem. So in other words, if our descendants, let's say, decide they want to artificially cool the climate, what's called geoengineering.
Okay. It's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. They spray sulfur into the atmosphere and it reflects sunlight back to space. And it's been discussed widely, though it's probably not a very good idea.
And what's the downside of it?
Well, it causes acid rain for one thing. Wow. It can cause ozone depletion for another, but perhaps most seriously, it could shift rain patterns around, and that would have tragic consequences for the billion or so people on Earth who make their livelihood from rain-fed agriculture. So anyway, it's...
Don't mess with Mother Nature,
yeah,
in other words.
But I'm saying that if for some reason people decide to cool off the northern hemisphere but not the southern hemisphere, then based on what we understand now, the rain belts will shift south, and that could trigger this big additional
that 15 degrees
warming.
Like you're talking,
yeah,
about. How high could this go, and how close are we to the tipping point? What is the tipping point beyond which climate change could be irreversible based upon your scientific study of this issue?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question. You know, we don't, unfortunately, know very well where that tipping point actually is. Many people over the years have said that 2 degrees is probably a safe number that we should not exceed, and that's 2 degrees centigrade or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And the scientific basis—
And that's an increase from when to when?
From pre-industrial, say from 1850 to whatever time we're talking
about. And how much
about.
Has it risen already?
It's already risen 0.8 centigrade. So we're almost halfway to that sort of danger point, 2 degrees.
How soon could we reach the tipping point if we don't do anything?
Well, that's the problem, is that really it's a really hard question to answer, because we don't have enough fundamental understanding of, you know, how to predict these tipping points. They're notoriously difficult to predict.
And but the consequences of doing nothing obviously could be.
Yeah. So
huge.
It's sort of a risk management question. If, you know, if your doctor says to you that you have a very high likelihood of a heart attack, but I can't tell you exactly what day your heart attack is going to happen.
There you go. But
would you just ignore your doctor's advice?
Good point. Or do you try to get your cholesterol down?
Yeah. Medical science isn't quite up to the task yet of predicting which day your heart attack is going to happen. But that still means you don't ignore your doctor.
Right.
It's kind of, that's kind of the place we're in with this abrupt climate change.
Okay. Can it be stopped is probably the $64,000 question there. And if so, what should we be doing to halt or reverse this trend?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, yes, it absolutely can be stopped. Don't listen to anyone who says that it's too late. We're all doomed. Let's just party until we die. Don't listen to those people. Okay. I mean, there is absolutely a lot we can do. And the big easy things to do that we should absolutely be doing right now is just converting everything to solar, especially in Southern California. Mm-hmm. We need to be all driving electric cars 30 years from now.
That we charge up on our solar systems.
We're blessed with abundant sunshine, mm-hmm. so we can all be driving solar-powered cars, basically. Mm-hmm. And so that trend is already sort of underway. It's, you know, but there needs to be public money spent because the private sector is still unwilling to take the big risks that are needed to invent the new technologies to make batteries a lot lighter and cheaper and make solar panels cheaper. So basically we need a revolution in how we get our energy. And it is possible, but it's going to take a little bit of priming the pump, basically. So
that brings me to a question about the Paris Climate Summit. As we're taping this, the world leaders are still meeting in Paris. They're just wrapping up the Global Climate Summit. Based on what you've seen so far happening in Paris, what is your assessment of the takeaway from that? Is enough being done? Are the world leaders taking this seriously enough, Jeffrey?
Well, I have to say I'm very encouraged by and very hopeful by what's going on in Paris right now. But if you just look at the numbers, they don't quite add up. I mean, the commitments to reduce CO2 emissions that have been put on the table at Paris are only about half of what's really needed to solve the problem. Effectively,
wow. If they did everything, if they adopted every single proposal,
yeah,
it still only gets us halfway.
It gets halfway, yeah. And so a lot of people have been acknowledging that openly. It's not like it's any secret, but
yeah,
what many of the world leaders are saying is this is just the beginning. It's politically too difficult to go all the way right now, but so we're taking baby steps. We're going to revisit this in another 5 years and then another 5 years after that. And hopefully by then, the politics will be more amenable.
We are seeing some progress. We're seeing the Chinese come to the table for the first time. Of course, they're one of the hugest polluters with the coal plants and so forth. So, I mean, that's a promising sign. But also around the world, a lot of places are saying we don't have to wait for our world leaders to take action. Let's do something ourselves. Aren't we seeing a movement of a lot of local mayors, for example? And I think the San Diego City Council is going to be voting in the next couple of weeks on going to a 100% renewable energy plan for the city.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see all the local action that's happening. Jerry Brown, our governor, has been really out in front on this issue. And, of course, he's been at the Paris talks, and he corralled basically enough cities and towns and states to account for a quarter of all global emissions of carbon dioxide.
Wow.
And they're all forming their own sort of action team, and they're going ahead. They're not waiting for the United Nations to do the work.
Well, that's fantastic, and I think that sometimes when it's done locally, in some ways it's done better. For example, in East County, I know not everyone was thrilled about the wind projects that, you know, the governor was a big supporter of because of the environmental damage of clear cutting, you know, 12,000 acres to put them in. But if you give a community a say so and they say, you know, we're happy to all put solar on our roofs or change what we drive or adopt mass transit, there's many, many approaches that can be taken to get us to the same goal. But with the support of the people that live in the communities instead of someone coming down and saying, you know, this is the only way to make it happen.
And I'm very encouraged that the private sector is really jumping into the fray. You know, Bill Gates and Elon Musk and a whole bunch of other super billionaires all put out a statement last week saying that they are going to put huge resources into figuring out how to make batteries lighter, how to make solar panels cheaper, mm-hmm. you know, all these important things that are going to be part of the solution.
So when we see the 1% turning around saying, we have to do something about this, we should all pay attention, I think.
No, it's very, very
hopeful. The greatest scientific and technology minds.
One way to look at this is in sort of crass monetary terms is that somebody is going to get filthy rich from this big energy transition that has to happen. So it's a kind of a question of, well, who is going to get super rich from doing this?
And speaking of the money, we really should mention that when we hear these prominent climate science deniers, many of them aren't even scientists, they're politicians or other folks out there, but there's an awful lot of money, isn't there, behind that, that's coming from, guess who? The fossil fuel industry that has so much to lose if we transition away from coal and oil and gas. Does this remind you of, you know, a couple decades ago when we saw the tobacco industry out there hiring so-called medical experts to say that tobacco doesn't cause cancer, cigarettes aren't bad for your health? And of course, they knew all along that it was.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read the papers about, you know, the last week or two about Exxon being investigated by the Attorney General of New York State.
Tell us some more about that.
Well, it turns out that Exxon had a lot of top scientists working on the problem in the 1960s and 1970s. Mm-hmm. And there was no secrets. The scientists were allowed to freely publish their own work. And they all said, you know, burning fossil fuels is going to cause global warming. And this is a problem, and the Exxon management was okay with that. And it turned out that in 1981, something flipped, something switched. You know, basically Exxon stopped funding all this basic scientific research.
Yeah, I wonder why. They didn't like the outcome too well.
Well, you know, it's tempting to speculate that their financial people just took a look at the numbers and said, if we want to make our stockholders happy, we just have to shut up and keep pumping. And so it's kind of a tragedy, but yeah, maybe there's a flaw in our economic system in that to keep the shareholders happy, you eventually do things that are not in the long-term best interests of everyone, including yourself.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of a self-destructive.
It's sort of a short-term versus long-term problem or something.
I'm going to give you the last word today, Jeffrey. What else would you like our listeners to know about climate change that we have not already mentioned today?
Well, I view climate change as a very soluble problem. I'm not a doom and gloom kind of guy at all. You know, I think there's a lot in common with sewage treatment, frankly. Nobody is against sewage treatment today. There is no such thing as a Republican position on sewage treatment or a Democratic position on sewage treatment. We just have to clean up after ourselves, and we all agree on that. I think in another 100 years, climate change is going to be seen the same way, just like we got to clean up after ourselves. And I think that it's very possible to do that. When sewage treatment was first introduced as an idea in the 1700s and then later in the 1800s, conservatives said that it would ruin the economy. Sound familiar?
It does. Fascinating.
And,
I did not know,
you know
that.
And I don't mean to make light of it, because actually at that time, pipes were not cheap. You know, you think about putting pipes through a whole city, you might actually, well, that's going to break the bank, you know, but it was possible. We did it. How did we do it? You know, a little bit at a time, incrementally, but it is absolutely possible to make this energy transition. And it's even possible to make a lot of money doing it. And I think one of the things I love about San Diego is that there's a lot of entrepreneurs in San Diego who have precisely this idea that they are going to make money by producing green technologies and making, you know, jobs. And who's against, you know, having more jobs and more money?
Nobody's absolutely against it. We really are the hub of the clean tech industry at a national level right here.
Absolutely,
in San Diego.
Yeah.
Right on the forefront of it.
And we could be better. We could be the go-to place for solar technology.
Listeners, if you tuned in late, we've been speaking with Jeff Severinghouse, who is a noted climate scientist from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography right here at the University of California, San Diego. Jeffrey, I want to thank you so very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering,
Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
California's strict gun laws are safe for now, after the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday rejected a case that could have overturned the Golden State's ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition. The court left in place a local assault ban in Highland Park, Illinois, which means similar bans in other states remain legal. Attorney Mike McLively with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence based in San Francisco says this bolsters his group's argument that common sense gun laws don't violate the Second Amendment, and he credits California's approach with a big drop in shootings.
California's gun death rate since the early 90s, when California started passing a lot of pretty comprehensive gun reforms, that gun death rate has gone down substantially and at a much greater rate than the rest of the country.
California passed an assault weapons ban in 1989. The federal ban passed in 1994 but was allowed to expire 10 years later. Opponents say gun control laws unfairly punish law-abiding gun owners and are ineffective because criminals buy weapons on the black market. McLively says the state still sees too many assault rifles because manufacturers have exploited a loophole to get around the ban, producing a rifle with a magazine controlled by a so-called bullet button.
It's very easy to produce an assault weapon where the magazine pops out if you wear a glove that has sort of a bullet attached to the index finger, and it's this way of getting around California law.
The two shooters in the recent terrorist attack in San Bernardino reportedly used legally obtained assault-style rifles that were bullet-button enabled and semi-automatic handguns. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a bill in 2013 to close the bullet-button loophole. In the wake of the massacre, gun control groups are pushing for it to be reintroduced in 2016. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The San Diego Fire Department has ruled that a fire that started in a house rented by tenants by San Diego State was an arson, NBC7 reports. Firefighters reported to the home around 6 o'clock p.m. on Thursday night and extinguished the fire by 6:23 p.m. Damages are estimated to be between $150,000 for the home and $50,000 to what was inside the home. According to tenants, the property was not suitable to be living in and was facing several violations, including wiring, plumbing problems, and no smoke alarms. One of the tenants claimed that the landlord was not supposed to be renting out the house. Around 11 renters live in the house. They all escaped the fire safely. The San Diego Police Department has now taken over the case. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Liz Albert.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community. This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. The Anza Borrego Foundation, official partner of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, has announced final elements in conservation of the Lucky Five Ranch in the Laguna Mountains, northeast of San Diego. The action creates a wildlife corridor that will be a continuous connection of publicly protected lands from the desert floor to the mountains. The foundation purchased just under 1,100 acres and obtained a conservation easement on 433 acres to fulfill a decades-long effort by California State Parks, the foundation, the Nature Conservancy, and other groups to connect the 4,200-acre ranch to adjacent pieces of federal and state conservation land, creating a major parcel of exceptional natural beauty and biological importance. The acreage will eventually become part of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park. This large confluence of protected lands provides recreational opportunities, sites for research and study, expanses of scenic landscape, support for abundant wildlife, and potential for several species of animals to relocate if needed because of climate change effects, according to the Anza Borrego Foundation. It also preserves ranching history dating back to the late 19th century. Anza Borrego Desert State Park Superintendent Kathy Dice says these are the very things that fall into the mission of California State Parks, to preserve the best of California forever. The Lucky Five Ranch property, first homesteaded in 1860, lies between two large state parks, Anza Borrego Desert and Cuyamaca Rancho State Park. In the early 1970s,
This property was considered for addition to the California State Park system, but due to budget limits, Lucky Five remained the property of the Daly family. Fueled by an offer of a $2 million private donation, efforts to obtain the property accelerated in the late 1990s. The Anzabrego Foundation used that donation, along with some federal and state grants and its own funds, to purchase two-thirds of the ranch back in 2001. The land was then transferred to the state and added to the Anzabrego Desert State Park. Since then, State Parks has expanded its riding and hiking trails system within Anzabrego Desert and Cuyamaca Rancho State Parks, enhancing access to Cuyamaca Lake, Pacific Crest Trail, and the California Riding and Hiking Trail. These connections among protected properties provided by the Lucky Five Ranch are consistent with a major shift in state park planning in the 90s. Rather than continue to establish standalone parks, the goal changed to connect existing open space preserves to state parks. The conservation easement permits the Daly family to own the property, live in the ranch house, and enjoy the use of the ranch while protecting the preserved areas. But no new structures can be built outside of a limited area, nor can the land ever be subdivided or developed by any current or future property owner. Among the wildlife supported in this new protected corridor are golden eagles, mountain lions, bobcats, gray fox, mule deers, and numerous species of reptiles and birds, as well as endangered plants.
A large group of California religious leaders released a letter to President Barack Obama Tuesday, asking him to use his powers under the Antiquities Act to create three new national monuments in the Southern California desert. 100 Latino church leaders from the Assemblies of God Southern Pacific District sent the letter, which urges the creation of the Mojave Trails, Castle Mountains, and Sand to Snow National Monuments. Reverend Jesse Villarreal from the Templo La Hermosa in Coachella says local churches often take youth groups on hikes to these proposed monuments because they are part of God's gift to humanity.
It's a place to relax, to pray, to connect with God and enjoy His beauties and see God through the hands of His creation. It's a place where you can meditate on God's power.
Supporters of the monuments say the area is threatened by proposals to export groundwater from the desert aquifers and from air pollution, rapid community development, and encroachments from renewable energy projects. Maite Arce with the nonprofit Hispanic Access Foundation says Latinos make up nearly 50% of the population in the California desert, so they have an important voice in the protection of public lands.
These communities really see the importance of these monuments to their heritage, to their communities, to future generations, and to their faith.
The clergy join a growing list of monument supporters who have written to the president, including historians, veterans, active duty military, local elected officials, Latino organizations, astronomers, and local business owners. Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill to establish these national monuments earlier this year, but it has not yet been brought to a vote. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Liz Albert with the Crime Beat Report. A parole violator in a stolen vehicle led a sheriff's deputy on a wild chase through unincorporated El Cajon last Tuesday morning. The parolee, 27-year-old Raymundo Calderon, was driving the black Honda with no license plates when he made an incorrect lane change. A deputy pulled him over on Graves Avenue in Bostonia and learned that Calderon was driving a stolen vehicle, but when asked to step out of the vehicle, Calderon instead drove away, according to Sergeant David Hale with the San Diego Sheriff's Department, and the pursuit began. Calderon crashed into another vehicle, which slid down an embankment, and next crashed into a parked truck on Greenfield Drive. He then ran into an apartment complex on Greenfield Drive and later tried to carjack a vehicle that had stopped in the street due to the collision, but was fended off by the owner of the car, Sergeant Hale said. Calderon then climbed a fence leading to a mobile home park in the 400 block of Greenfield. K-9s, helicopters, detectives, and patrols from the Sheriff's Department were all dispatched to establish a perimeter. Calderon, who was on parole for robbery, was taken into custody on charges of felony evading arrest, possession of a stolen vehicle, hit and run, and carjacking.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Coming up next, the Chaldean Corner on East County Magazine's radio show, bringing you news for and about our region's Iraqi Chaldean community.
This is Ed Barena on the East County Magazine radio show. I'm here in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, our special guest is Jawdat Alabedi. He's organizing a community event. Thanks, Jawdat, for being here.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm honored to be here with you.
Thanks for coming in. So tell us about your event that's coming up.
Yes, it's a youth conference, Challenges and Solutions. I'm organizing this conference in El Cajon City on December the 17th, 11 a.m. at the Royal Palace on Broadway. The purpose of this conference, actually, to focus on the challenges of our youth here in the community. Definitely, they have challenges, they have problems, they have obstacles. So we would like to discuss with the youth and some youth organizations and people who are in charge or responsible for the community youth here in El Cajon or San Diego to discuss openly and widely some points, some obstacles, some challenges in their life, to focus on the solution, and we will suggest the solution to the people in charge here in the city, and we will discuss after the conference with them how to deal with these challenges, how to find a way to ease their life. Also, we would like to develop youth leaders in the community. Youth are very important for everybody. They are the present and they are the future. And they have to have a good role, positive role, and we would like to educate them that they can speak out, they can discuss, they can improve their lives in the community, engaging with other activities, integrating the people, the youth in this community is very important.
Yes, I imagine that it must be tough sometimes for someone who might be a refugee to come to a new area in a new country that they're unfamiliar with the customs and everything, and to try to start a new life here, it might be very tricky. We were talking about your background before the interview here, and it sounds like you've been through some adversity. Tell us a little bit about what you experienced in life.
Yes, of course. Actually, I was one of the opposition leaders in north of Iraq against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein regime. And we've been working hard to advocate for democracy and civil society in Iraq against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. And after he invaded the no-fly zone on August the 31st, 1996, they captured many members of the opposition leaders. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the people who've been captured and tortured for about a year and a half. Then I've been discharged by the help of the Red Cross organization, the international organization, and I got the asylum visa to United States of America. I was lucky with my family to be here, and I start advocating for civil society and integrating the community and doing positive things for the community, serving here, and sometimes we do youth events, sometimes civil society and women's event. And I try to focus on this conference on the youth because I believe that youth have a very significant role and they have to be active in this community.
Yes, the youth definitely can get easily distracted from being productive and things like that. But it sounds like you went through a lot there being a political prisoner, and it's nice to see you come in and be a community organizer here in San Diego. So we appreciate you here in East County coming through.
Sure.
Out of this conference, what is the main goal? It sounds like it's to create a sort of consensus among your community in a way to better integrate into the El Cajon community overall.
Yes, the main purpose of this conference is we try to educate our youth, especially those who came recently from the Middle East, from my country, Iraq. They have a different culture and they have a different way of living. They're not used to stand and speak about their challenges and their obstacles. So they have to sit and their family, they taking care of them. Here in America, the life is different and the rule is different. Here, everybody have the right to speak out. Here, they have to practice their freedom of speech, freedom of opinion. Without speaking from the youth, you cannot find any solution and you cannot improve their lives. And if we don't improve their lives, the youth lives, the future will be a different future, actually. We focus on the right, the present, and the future. Youth should be have a very good roles in the community. That's why we call them to speak out and to discuss openly and to engage in this event and other community events.
That's great. And so, once again, the event is a youth conference with the Iraqi Center for Dialogue, and that's going to be on December 17th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's a Thursday at 1340 Broadway in El Cajon. And to RSVP, you can email dialogue@centeriraq.org. And I believe you can go to that website and get some more information there, potentially?
Yes, actually, this event been posted on Facebook and Twitter and all event site and Eventbrite site. You can check even on Google it, and you can find the details of this conference, the time and the date and the location. And it's a public event. We invite the youth to come join the discussion. We invite the youth organization. We invite any local office here in the city of El Cajon who taking care of youth issue, youth challenges. They can come to join, and the media also, they can come to join the discussion.
Yeah, so it's open doors, basically, to come down and get involved in the community.
Of course.
So what do you think are some of the main problems that are facing Iraqi youths in the local community?
Well, the main committee of this conference, they have pointed many points, many obstacles, but we have decided to discuss five challenges, which is it actually the first one is the language barriers, and the second one is the cultural differences, and the third one is the employment or the job opportunities, mm-hmm. and legal problems, and the problem of addiction. So these are five obstacles, five main points we will have to discuss, and it depend on the time. So we have put priorities, which is we put number one, the language, and number two, the employment challenges, and so on. And based on the time, if we can cover the five challenges, that will be good. If not, we will take one by one, and we'll see. We'll go from there.
Yeah, I know addiction is something that is cross-cultural.
You know that, yeah.
Okay, well, that sounds very organized, and it sounds like it's going to be really productive and inspiring, and I think that's good for members of the entire community of El Cajon should be interested in attending this event if you want to be involved.
Definitely.
Maybe we can talk about some of the solutions for some of these problems potentially. What would be a good solution for the language barrier? Because I know that's sort of tough for anyone who's sort of new to a new area and doesn't speak the language. That's got to be kind of intimidating.
Yes. Language barrier, actually, it's a very big problem. And it starts when first came from the airport, and he started his first day. He started challenged, and he started facing a problem of language. This problem is not easy, actually. The most important things in the language problem is we have people who come from Iraq from a different education level. So we have people who don't read and write. And we have people who have professors and bachelor degree, master degree in some area who are not speaking English, or they have less English, very low English. So I don't think it's going to be easy, but we can suggest, actually. ESL, it's a program which has been taken care of many cities and many colleges here and many schools. But still, there are some challenges in it, because ESL is a program for everybody, for anybody. Mm-hmm. But You know, when you put somebody who have a bachelor degree in ESL program, he will get it done in very quickly,
yes,
and he will learn English so fast. Mm-hmm. But when you have somebody who have no English at all, or he have just elementary school from Iraq,
yeah,
I mean, his Arabic level is too low, so it's going to be difficult to have him learn how to speak, write, and read English very well. So this is the main challenges and the barrier of language. So if there is ability, or if there is any schools that can taking care of the people who are not reading or speaking any other language very well, so this will be very helpful for our youth. And for those who are high school or middle school level, it's very easy for them. So, because they will attend the school the next day when they arrive here, mm-hmm, and they will start engaging and socializing with their friends in the same age in the school, and with the ESL program at the same school. So they find it easy how to learn English, the new language, and also they will find it easy how to learn the new cultural. Mm-hmm. So for those people, the youth, middle school and high school, it's very easy, but for the others, it's still difficult, and there should be another way or solution to engage them in learning English.
An adult here. ESL
yeah.
program
adult,
would be
yeah,
very
exactly.
helpful, yes.
Yeah.
Maybe like
exactly.
A very basic program for people who are
exactly
won't just grasp it, maybe can't read the translations on the
exactly.
board, things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's things that, you know, people maybe don't always think about when they think about
exactly.
these people coming
yeah.
here. And, you know, we're here to offer our freedom, you know, and I think that it's great to have people coming from other cultures, and
yes.
especially when they engage, it makes our whole community stronger.
Exactly.
And that's a great example of what's going to happen
yeah.
at this conference. So, if you have a chance, once again, that's going to be Thursday, the 17th, 11 to 2 at the Royal Palace at 1340 Broadway, El Cajon.
11 a.m.
At 11 a.m. And you can RSVP at dialogue@centeriraq.org. Thanks, Jawdat, for being here. And good luck with everything, and maybe we'll see you down at the conference.
Thank you very much, sir, and thank you for having me here. And also, I would like to repeat the invitation for the youth in El Cajon and San Diego area, and parents, fathers, and moms to attend this discussion and to engage with us to improve our youth lives. Thank you.
You are listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Hello, my name is David Dickens, David Charles Dickens to be exact. I want to talk to you today, audience, about the links between me and Charles Dickens and the writers that have become in our family. According to my late grandfather, Charles Elmer Dickens, who died in the summer of 1992, prior to departing, I was told I am related to Charles Dickens, one of our greatest authors of all time, and I am four generations down, so a great, 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 great grandfather right down the family tree. I'm a current freelancer for East County Magazine, write mostly sports features. However, if something creative comes my way, I'm always happy to take it. Also come from another family member, my father, Bill Dickens, who currently owns EastCountySports.com, has been covering sports locally in East County for over 43 years. I'm going to speak about Charles Dickens today and one of his finest novels, A Christmas Carol, that was written in December of 1843. Not only is this a great selection for the season, but also referring to Dickens' early childhood, humiliating experiences, his sympathy for the poor folks, and great fairy tales he was read as a child. The lesson that should be learned from this particular novel is how greed and the love of money can lead to destruction, selfishness. But in the end, after visits from the Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future spirits from the novel, Ebenezer Scrooge learns to appreciate life If we as human beings have an abundance of wealth, it should be shared with the less fortunate. The love of human beings far outweighs the gift of wealth. Dickens' humiliating experiences are not specifically indicated in this novel. However, his conflicting feelings for his father as a result of these experiences are responsible for the double personality of the novel's protagonist, Ebenezer Scrooge. In 1824, Dickens' father, John, was hauled off to prison at the Marshalsea, and Charles, 12 at the time, only 12, was forced to stay at inns nearby, pawn off his great book collection, and drop out of school, and take up employment at a blacking factory. Charles had a deep sense of etiquette and intellect, and was very uncomfortable in the factory atmosphere and the co-workers who worked directly with him. His co-workers referred to him as the young gentleman. Charles' father was released after 3 months in confinement. His father made him return to the factory instead of going back into school, which obviously was a mistake, and it only angered and humiliated Charles even further. Charles basically says his happy life went on to be nothing but anguish and pain. These disturbances cause many psychological issues and haunting memories, as Charles goes on. Charles both loved and despised his father. These psychological issues assisted in creating the two different personalities of Ebenezer Scrooge, a cold, stingy, greedy individual, and on the other personality, sociable generosity and goodwill toward all men was his outlook, an angel type of man. Another inspiration was early in his childhood that he observed the lives of men, women, and children in the most poverty-stricken areas of London and witnessed the social injustices they suffered. So basically, he went on after writing this novel, and he actually, years later, he took it to another level and actually was reading it live on stage, which definitely got a great following. And once he departed, of course, we also know quite a few people went on to create A Christmas Carol movie. I believe the most recent one that everybody has probably seen, the animated version of A Christmas Carol starring Jim Carrey, which is definitely something to see, but it's more a comedic look into the actual novel, which that's not the direction that Charles Dickens was really wanting you to understand. And what I would like you folks in the audience to get from this really is, let's enjoy ourselves as a family and have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and not be all about the gifts and what we could and could not afford this year. Just the warm hearts, getting together, and loving each other. I leave you with that, and this is David Charles Dickens signing off. And again, have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year on behalf of East County Magazine.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, royalty-free music, Frank Nora, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.